And here we are. And I'm glad there's been a fair bit of anticipation and expectation for tonight. For whatever reason that might be, but here we are, the night we've all been waiting for. And with all the anticipation leading up to it, to be honest, I feel a bit like a young man on his wedding night. Lots of excitement, lots of expectation, but desperately hoping I don't disappoint anybody. Over the past month or so, Bron's probably, rightly so, for the first time ever in our marriage, I'm sure, has been able to accuse me of having sex on the brain for a whole month. But in that time, I trust the Lord's actually been preparing myself for tonight, as well as each of us. And he's actually been preparing me for tonight's topic for, well, probably my whole life, as we look at the topic of grace-filled intimacy. It's been said that on your wedding night, when you go to bed with your new wife or your new husband, that you don't go to bed just with two people, but you go to bed actually with six or more. You go to bed with your new wife or husband and her parents and your parents. You can't ever cut yourself off from your background and your upbringing and your past, can you? Whether that's failures or just the way you've been brought up. We bring all of that with us, all of that history with us, for better or for worse. It's an interesting image, isn't it, thinking of your wedding night with six of you there? But for preachers, pastors and preachers, not just on topics like this, but any topic, to look at the Word of God and to read it and study it and come under it objectively, something we have to very deliberately do is try to actually separate ourselves from our own experience and background and say, what is God saying here to everybody? At the same time, we've got to acknowledge that there is part of me that speaks out of my own experience, my own upbringing and situations here. My trust and hope tonight is that I can be as biblical and objective as possible as we share on these things tonight. The area of marriage and the area of intimacy particularly is one that carries with it probably the most excitement and anticipation, but often also the most fear and anxiety for a couple. There can be a whole lot of pleasure, perhaps the most pleasure you can ever think of, but at the same time, it can cause the most pain. There can be great fulfillment, but also great frustration, and anger even. Intimacy can be something so sweet, but can very quickly turn into something so sour between husband and wife. It's probably one of the most thought about subjects, but perhaps one of the least talked about subjects, even in the marriage. And that's an issue in itself. Probably many of us find it hard to talk about these things. Just the comments I've had in this month leading up to this, they said, you're very brave doing this, or things like that, which tells us there's a little bit of hesitation in approaching these things. And as I said, even between husbands and wives. Hopefully tonight helps break the ice if it's something you find difficult to talk about together. There'll be issues that you can say, hey, remember what Ray showed us or what Ray said? Don't just say, because Ray said, you got it a little bit different to that. But hopefully it just helps break the ice. Don't be ashamed if it's been a difficult issue to talk about. It is for most people. But at the same time, don't be slow in breaking through that sort of area of discomfort and talking about it together in the context of this whole series, which is, remember, grace-filled marriage. And that's the area that we speak about grace-filled intimacy, is in the context of God's grace. This series that we've been doing hasn't really been set up for a lot of interaction and discussion between yourselves. There are some courses that do that. There's a sort of like an alpha course that's run for marriage at the moment, which is very much set up as a sort of date night. You get to sit at a table with your husband or wife, you hear a certain bit, and then you get to talk about that issue together and go home and do the homework. Some of those things might be really helpful just to help through that. Nathan Elgar's also let me know about a camp that takes place. It's a marriage retreat type idea where you get together, you have to put your kids aside and put them somewhere else for a weekend. You might think there's better things to do if that could happen, but here's a weekend that I know the Elgar. I haven't been, so I can't necessarily endorse it, but the Hulls and the Elgars, maybe the Stanfields have gone, and they could tell you all about it. And I think from memory, yes, Nathan's parents are on the back here. There's a couple that run it. So you might be interested in something like that, which goes through 12 areas of marriage, and within the weekend gives you time to go aside and talk together about the things that you've just heard about. So it's a wonderful thing. It's great to hear these things, that in a grace-filled marriage, in communion together, to talk about them is really important. More than all of that, though, this is an area that I think we need to feel free enough to talk about, because the world, and the evil one in particular, from the very beginning, has wanted to drive a wedge between husband and wife, hasn't he? From the very outset, he knew that his target was going to be marriage. It was going to be the intimate relationship of communion between man and woman that he was going to try to get his teeth into, get in on the action, and cause separation. Try to separate what God has brought together to become one flesh. He's been at it from the very outset, and he's still at it. And I reckon one of the reasons he's at it so strongly, particularly in marriage, family, and in the area of intimacy, is because if he can get between a husband and a wife, he is the closest he will ever get to dividing Christ and his church, the true bride, the true husband and bride. He can't touch that. But if he can get between us as husbands and wives, that's as close as he'll get. If we are the ectype of Christ and his bride, the archetype, if we're to display the glory and grace of Christ and his bride, he can't get to that, but if he can get between us, he's doing the next best thing. Which is actually one of the reasons why I'm so keen and have been eager to share this whole series, but tonight in particular. The voices of the world are so loud on these topics, and they're so prevalent, and they're so fierce. And if we don't, as God's people, actually declare God's word into our marriages, in these areas where the world is just throwing images and voices at us left, right and centre, then all the more fools we are if we don't actually declare God's word. If things go pear-shaped, then we're to blame if we haven't actually looked to see what God has to say about something he's made so wonderful and glorious. Fortunately, God cares enough for us, and he's not too embarrassed to broach the issue. His scriptures are full of it, and tonight we're going to have a look at a good handful of scriptures regarding marriage, but in particular, intimacy together. We don't have time to look at a full, comprehensive study on it all, but this study is part of the series, so if you haven't listened to the first couple, they're online with sermon audio, I encourage you to do that. This one comes deliberately in the middle. It comes deliberately after headship and submission, and after grace-filled marriage, for a reason. Having said that, intimacy in a marriage is not something we can compartmentalise outside of a marriage or even within a marriage, is it? It's not just something that happens on its own, separate from the other part of life. It happens all at once. And so whilst we don't want to compartmentalise marriage too much, tonight we are looking at the topic of intimacy within marriage. And I trust that tonight we hear what the Lord has to say to us in regards to these things. Because, as we well know, there's plenty of resources out there, worldly as well as Christian, some of them helpful and some of them not so. Even in our Christian bookstores, you could walk in there and I would say, don't go near some of that stuff. It's not helpful. Some of it is, some of it isn't. Especially the ones where they tend to eliminate or destroy that journey of discovery that I think needs to take place between a husband and wife together. Books that are so graphic and explicit in their detail, which actually completely obliterate that journey and discovery and almost ruin any innocence as a young Christian husband and wife come together, I think can be really unhelpful. It brings images and expectations from outside of your oneness into that and can actually be harmful. There's some books that I can stand in Coorong and flick through and actually blush thinking I'm reading them. And I'm in a Christian bookstore as a married man. But before we go any further, when we speak of intimacy in a marriage, what is it we're talking about? What sort of things come to mind? Nothing, right? We'll go home and...
Being sweet.
Yeah. Okay.
I say close.
Close.
Being able to share...
Yeah, okay, so sharing your innermost thoughts. That means talking. Oh, we'll get being on the same team. Yep. Holding hands. There's a physical element to intimacy, isn't there?
Good.
It goes anything from holding hands to a kiss and a cuddle to intercourse, doesn't it? And for every degree within. It's more than just sex, isn't it? It is more than that, although that's the stereotypical sort of view we have of what intimacy might be. But it could be just holding hands or going for a walk down the beach or having a conversation on the phone when you're apart from one another. There's still intimate moments there to be shared. It might be just being held in each other's arms. Guys, sometimes our ladies, that's all they want and nothing more. And just to be able to rest and trust in that. One resource I read spoke of four different types of intimacy, not just between husbands and wives, but just between people in general. Cognitive or intellectual intimacy, where you share ideas together. And you can do that on a wonderful level, and actually, yeah, you're sort of on the same team together and working through, and you just realise there's some intimate moments. Experiential, where there's a mutual involvement in an activity. It even might be painting a wall, but you're doing that together. You ever watch two people doing something just in this wonderful synchronisation? They don't even realise they're doing it, but there's just a wonderful intimacy that goes on there in action. And then there's the emotional level of intimacy, where you're sharing deep thoughts and emotional understanding and empathy. And then the fourth form is the sexual intimacy, where you're sharing on a more physical level. Now, whilst there's books and other things around which talk about love languages and other things like different levels of intimacy, each of those forms of intimacy are actually connected. And would it be fair to say that many of us, and I think particularly for our wives, that unless there's a level of trust and intimacy at maybe those first three levels, then sexual intimacy is really difficult? Unless there's a level of closeness and togetherness and teamwork happening at the emotional and the intellectual and the activity sort of level, then sexual intimacy just doesn't quite have its fullness with it. Would that be fair to say? The same goes within the different levels of intimacy. Like I said, just holding hands or having a cuddle to form the trust that that's all you're going to get for now might actually be what's needed to grow the confidence for the other degrees of intimacy further down the track. Guys, sometimes we need to be really patient on that and understanding, which we're going to look at in a moment. Tim Hawkes is a principal, a college principal in Melbourne, I think it was. He's actually twin brother to a pastor, Nick Hawkes, who's local in Adelaide. You may know him. But he's recently written, particularly regarding boys, but not just fellas, that we need to teach our young people to realise and allow for what he describes as the four seasons of growth in relationships. Summer, winter, autumn, spring. And so often, especially with what the world is throwing at us, guys just want spring all the time. Fertility, rich, and lots of life. And life doesn't work without four seasons, does it? And relationships can't either. There need to be ebbs and flows. Trees that bear fruit don't grow well if they don't have a dormant season. And so our relationships do as well. Creation doesn't work when it's always spring. Intimacy won't work if it's always spring. So intimacy is not just sex. And it's definitely not always, and perhaps never, will it involve swinging from the chandeliers when Harry met Sally, I'll have what she's having type of orgasmic intercourse. It won't always be that. If you haven't seen the movie, it's a bit of a comedy from the 90s. Let you work out whether you want to watch it or not. But even in this room, there's a huge difference in opinions as to what intimacy is, what it should be, what we want it to be, and what reality is. The difference between our ideals and reality, and it's actually grace that has to realise maybe those ideals need to be put aside and work with the reality with each other. With all that the world throws at us, and I think at times screams at us, you've only got to go get your hair cut to be seen magazines or walk past a news agency. You've got images just barraging you left, right and centre of what the world says our relationship should be like and even our sex life should be like. Fair comment? We don't even have to open the covers. And I actually want to just show you, not too much, but just a few magazine covers, some of the safer ones, more appropriate ones. Let's just see what the world throws at us. Cosmo? Sorry about the flicky screen. Here we go. Four women master the art of total sexual confidence. But it was only four women who claimed that. So if that's not you, if you're not one of those four, at least you can make sure you've got the right shoes. I think it's amazing that they can sell sex and shoes in the same magazine. Well, we live in a global age, so of course we should look globally to find out about mind-blowing hookups, shouldn't we? Or perhaps just discover the ultimate secrets to thicker, sexier hair. And ladies, just in case you didn't know what your husbands are thinking about all the time, you can find out exactly what is inside his brain. But we live in a gender-inclusive society, don't we? So maybe we should have a look at what the guys are getting to read and what they're looking at as well. Five things to say to a naked woman. Doesn't even presume she's your wife, probably assumes she's not. What about, whoa, man? That's what Adam said. That's why she's called woman. He's bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. That's the first thing a man said to the first naked woman he saw. Sure, those five things. I didn't open the magazine to find out. That probably wasn't what they said. But it's probably not get your clothes on either. But if that doesn't interest you, then at least you can win enough steak to last you for a year. And the amazing thing is, even the men get advice on shoes in a men's health magazine. 41 best new shoes for men. What is it with shoes? I don't know. So you can have all the best footwear, and you can last all night, get your sex drive into overdrive, but if you do manage that, you'll need to be able to brew the perfect cup of coffee just to stay awake. This next one claims to know everything she wants about sex, and at the same time give you a Hugh Jackman physique, 18 instant grooming fixes, and all the grill skills and chef secrets you need with a bonus beer to wash it all down. The world and the devil are screaming at us loud and clear, aren't they, about what sex and intimacy and relationships should all be like. But it's all from the outside and putting pressure on us within our marriages. And so I actually wanted to start this evening with a few headlines of my own, headlines from the scriptures on the issues of sex, intimacy and relationships. God's not ashamed to talk about it. He's actually declared it to us and guides us in our relationships. Maybe not as explicitly as some of these articles do, but if he doesn't do it that explicitly, then maybe we need to nod as well, and we need to hear what he has to say rather than what the world's saying. He's the creator of us, man and woman. He's the one who brings two together to be one. Paul says he's the father from whom all familyhood is derived. He's the one we should be turning to work out how to work out our relationships, even in the bedroom, in our intimate times, which might not just be the bedroom. Here goes. Some biblical headlines. Concerning sex, Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. Lips dripping with nectar, Song of Solomon. Is your man's body like polished ivory? Sex, don't stop. Not for too long anyway, Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. Let's get drunk on love. Breasts which satisfy your man, Proverbs 5. Naked and unashamed, Genesis 2. And even the scriptures have a sealed section. Set me as a seal upon your heart, for love is as strong as death. Bible and God are not ashamed to talk about these things. And therefore we shouldn't be either, but in the context and the confines of God's grace and of the unity that we have, the union, communion that we have ourselves in marriage. I actually reckon sex in a Christian marriage should be better than anything Hollywood or Bollywood or anything else should be able to offer. Not because it's going to be more real and more personal. If anything, sometimes that can just make it more messy and more embarrassing. But because in a Christian marriage, that's the only place there can be genuine self-giving in love. It's the only place where we can be naked and completely unashamed without guilt. Completely. It's only there that we know for ourselves as well as for our spouse that they are clean, they've been washed clean, they're forgiven, no more guilt, no more sin. And it takes all of that for us to enjoy the purity and greatness of our one flesh union together in every aspect of it, and to celebrate that together. It's actually given to us to enjoy, husbands and wives together, and with thankful hearts. You know, Adam just jumped for joy when God gave him the companion that was just right for him. And he cherished her, even though he stuffed up so quickly. Most of us guys do. But it was something really special. And it was from God, wasn't it? She was a gift from God to him. Ladies, wives, you're a gift from God to your husbands. And vice versa too. And the wonderful thing, as we hear in the scriptures and as we heard in the first talk, as well as in the second, is that marriage as a whole, that even in the intimacy of marriage, is only a display and a demonstration of something far more glorious, far more mind-blowing than we can ever imagine when it comes to Christ and his bride, the church. So, just to convince you all of, with all of that, whenever you've got any headlines, magazine headlines, you need a cover girl or a cover guy, don't you? If there's any single ones here, you might like to close your eyes for this one. Only kidding. My cover girl is the hottest woman in the Bible. Or at least Solomon thought so. There she is, with her dove-like eyes, her pomegranate cheeks, her neck like stone, breasts like twin gazelles, grazing among the lilies, not to mention her lovely belly with wheat, a little sack of wheat. If you haven't read Song of Songs, that's what she looks like. Well, it's what he describes her as anyway. Solomon thought she was altogether beautiful and flawless. Sadly, Solomon had many wives, didn't he? That was his downfall. But God, we're told elsewhere and encouraged elsewhere to treat our wives as precious jewels. Because that's what they are. Not because they're physically attractive, but simply because they're our wife. Cherish them. Honour them. God's good gift for us and to each other. And fellas, we're told not to go near any other woman or any other form of seduction. That path leads down only to death. Instead, from Proverbs, husbands, we are to drink water from our own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets? He's not talking about your puritat here. Let them be for yourself alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. A lovely deer, a graceful doe, let her breasts fill you at all times with delight. Be intoxicated always in her love. Why should you be intoxicated, my son, with a forbidden woman and embrace the bosom of an adulteress? Do as Job says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin or another woman? And that includes on our screens as well as at the beach or anywhere else. The forms of temptation may have changed with technology, printing presses and whatever else, but the content's still the same. And God, in his grace, is still the same as well. And he promises us with any temptation, there is always a way of escape that he provides. And a rest-a-bed of grace. You ever gone down the freeway and you see the rest-a-beds there? And the last one, it says last chance, a rest. God's like that in life. He gives you an rest-a-bed after rest-a-bed. Pull out before you get too far down that slippery slope. Because that slippery slope leads to destruction. And I've seen the walls down at the bottom of the freeway and the destruction that a truck that's lost its brakes can form. Don't let that happen in your marriage. Take the arrest of better grace before it's too late. And as we'll see later on tonight, fellas and ladies, your best and first most important defence against any such temptation actually lies right next to you each night. But for now, a love song. Let's get drunk on love together. Anyone who's read the Song of Solomon? Okay, most, some, two-thirds. There's a lot of different views on how we should read the Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs. It's not meant to be taken literally. It's poetry. And there's a whole lot of metaphors and a whole lot of euphemisms and a whole lot of imagery there that even some of the commentators are a little bit shy at telling us what it means. There are different views of it. What I want to look at tonight is a section in chapter 5 and share with you some of the views that are there, or at least one view that's there, which I think is quite an appropriate one. This is a biblical love song. It talks about a relationship between a man and a woman before marriage. Don't awaken love until the time's right. But then when love is awakened and what happens there, and the joy, but also the worry and the other aspects of life that take place. I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. But I had put off my garment, how could I put it on? I had bathed my feet, how could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh, and on the handles of the bolt. I opened to him, my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. We're meant to read that as it's intended, and that is metaphorically. He's not worried really about standing out in the rain and getting his hair wet. He's worried about the fact that he's so full of desire and stimulated with desire for his new bride that he can't contain himself any longer. And she, despite her desire and her love for her husband, when the moment of truth arrives, she hesitates. She's kept herself for this moment. All her life, she's guarded and protected what she longs to give to someone, to her husband, that one day, in complete purity to him. But when love is awakened, even though it's now all above board and all right and godly, there's a reluctance, there's a hesitancy to give up that purity which has so long been part of who she is. And there's even a sense of fear that untouched chastity is about to be touched. That she's about to give up what she's held and protected for so long that she can only do once in a lifetime. And she knows there's likely to be some pain involved as well. When he asks her to open to him, when she eventually arises to his urgent pleas and puts his hand to the latch, and she puts her hands on the handles of the bolt and her heart's thrilled within her and their hair and their hands are wet with dew, they're not talking about a big wooden door and a bolt on that door. It's the tender, delicate moment of arousal and consummation together. And all of that's mixed with a sense of urgency and desire, as well as an equal sense of hesitation and concern from the woman. And then verse 6, as quick as it's begun, it's over. For all his desperate pleading, once relieved of his desire, she wants to speak to him, she wants to talk. She's now desperate to find him, just as desperate as he was to find her. But he's rolled over. He's non-responsive. He's gone. And she doesn't know why. Now, whether it's our wedding night or any other intimate time together, a month, a year, decades later, the impulses and urges of a husband and wife, the desires and the concerns, they can be so far apart, can't they, and so different. From urgency and desire to hesitation and concern, desperate desire for physical union and relief, perhaps even to fear about letting go, even with the one that you know you love and want to be one with, but there's a vulnerability with that. One wants action sometimes, the other just wants to talk. One might want to talk before the action, the other wants action before talk. Now, I don't think for a minute men are from Mars and women are from Venus. But we are very different sometimes, aren't we, in the way we approach things, the way we think about things, sometimes from completely different angles, and particularly in the area of intimacy. I want you to have a look at this next clip. Listen carefully, because there's some amazing truth, I think quite profound treasures in here, but it also caused a bit of a laugh.
It's just, there's all this pressure. pressure, you know? And sometimes it feels like it's right up on me, and I can just feel it, like literally feel it in my head, and it's relentless, and I don't know if it's going to stop. I mean, that's the thing that scares me most, that I don't know if it's ever going to stop.
Yeah. Well, do you have a nail in your head?
It's not about the nail.
Are you sure? Because, I mean, I'll bet if we got that out of there...
Stop trying to fix it.
No, I'm not trying to fix it. I'm just pointing out that maybe the nail is causing...
You always do this. You always try to fix things when what I really need is for you to just listen.
See, I don't think that is what you need. I think what you need is to get the nail.
See,
out. Okay, fine. I will listen. Fine.
It's just... Sometimes, there's this achy... I don't know what it is. My sweaters are snagged. I mean, all of them.
That sounds really hard.
Thank you. Ow!
Oh, come on, if you would just...
Don't!
But it's so funny because it's so true, isn't it? For those listening, you have to look up on YouTube a clip called It's Not About the Nail. It has a go at both genders, doesn't it? And our stereotypical way of dealing with issues. One wants to fix the problem that's right there before his very eyes. The other wants to talk about it, or not even talk about the problem, just talk about how the problem makes her feel. She wants him to listen, to understand, and all he wants to do is grab the pliers and pull the thing out. Now, none of us would ever have a similar situation in our marriages, would we? Where someone can see the problem and the other one just wants a shoulder to cry on, just to be understood, just to listen. It's not all, we have to, in one sense, go with some stereotypes and generalisations. It's not always the guys that see the issue and the girls that want to talk, but a lot of the time it is, isn't it? Guys, husbands, here's an area of intimacy where it's probably most necessary to take Peter's advice. 1 Peter 3, verse 7, he says, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. Try to understand your wife. Try to understand the potential fear, the worries, the concerns that she might have. Might not be concerns about you, might not be worries about you, but it affects you because it affects her. She may love you more than you'll ever know, but it doesn't mean there won't be a sense of vulnerability or concern in the area of intimacy, and maybe even fear and pain. Part of living in an understanding way is to listen, even if the proverbial nail is sticking out right before your very eyes, and you think you could fix it just like that. Sometimes it's not about fixing the issue. The issue is deeper than the nail. Peter also says showing honour to her. As the weaker vessel, they may be weaker physically, but he says, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, you have no claim or right to anything more than what she does. You are co-heirs with her of God's grace. And so we live together in understanding one another. And in honour, but this is an instruction to fellas. And it's not just on our wedding nights that that understanding and honour needs to take place. It's all the way through our married lives together. And in the area of sexual intimacy, there's times probably when this understanding is more needed than others. There are times when, for particular reasons, after giving birth, certain times in the cycle of a woman, or just their physical, psychological or physiological makeup, that intimacy, sex in particular, might be the last thing on her mind. Live with your wives in an understanding way. Cherish them. As we've said before, it might be that just a kiss and a cuddle, or not even a kiss, just to be held is all that they need, when you want something far more. They might be more worried about getting the chores and the washing and the ironing done than having time together with you. And they might not be able to relax until all those chores are done. sadly, some of those chores seem perpetual and never ending. To which one wise husband once said, well, bring on the laundry. Let's get it done together. Thought about that? And on that note, wives, there might be times when you need to put aside that agenda and those chores and say, blow it, they might not get done. Not yet anyway. And give yourself to your husband. None of that, either side, should be conditional. When this is, no, it shouldn't be like that. If this, then that. Not verbally, not in your own heart. There's at least a couple of couples here without kids. Those of you with children will know that once children come along, things change a lot, don't they? All of a sudden the chores just multiply. What's on a mum's mind is very different to what's on a husband's or dad's mind. Often the fellas tend to take a back seat in the mind of our wives. That's necessary sometimes. It's perfectly natural. Especially when they're young. They need our mums more than they need their dads. Even if it's just for milk. Although these days, with formula and everything else, dads get to share in that joy of being up at 3 a.m. as well. But things change, don't they? You can't expect everything to go on just as it used to. Talk to one another. Try to understand those changes together. Because really in marriage, your spouse's situation is not your spouse's situation, it's your situation. You're one. There's not her and you, or him and I, or whatever. It's together. Guys, understand that your wife's body changes. Desires change, emotions change. Some women's bodies are never the same after having children. For some, not just externally, but internally. And for some, intercourse may actually be more painful than pleasurable. Many couples have to work through that. Ladies, understand that for us husbands, not much changes. You might wish that they did, but it doesn't for us. Our desire for you and our sex drive, that doesn't change just because we've now got children. And you might wish it was different, but it's not. That's how God's made us. So take it up with God, talk it together, and pray about it. Don't not pray about that. A word from John Piper, particularly to husbands, in his book, This Momentary Marriage, which we've mentioned a few times already. Guys, learn that preparation for satisfactory intercourse at 10 p.m. begins with tender words at 7 a.m. and continues through the day as kindness and respect. And when the time comes, you will not come on like a Sherman tank, but you will know her pace and bring her skillfully along. Unless she gives you the signal, you will say her climax, not mine, is the goal. And you will find in the long run that it's far more blessed to give than to receive. And Peter finishes this verse by saying, show honour, understand your wife, so that your prayers may not be hindered. Show me a couple who are having trouble praying together. And I'll show you a couple who are probably struggling to understand one another and probably struggling in the areas of intimacy as well. Fellas, John spoke last month about headship and submission. That doesn't stop. It doesn't evaporate in the heat of the moment. Headship and submission is part of marriage, full stop, in every regard. This is actually one area where your role and responsibility as head of the wife has to go full throttle. What does Paul say about that? Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. If you love your wives, are we willing to lay down our lives? Lay down our desires, our dreams and expectations, our own fulfillment for the sake of our wife? Are we willing to bear all things and endure all things and hope all things and not insist on our own way? Wives, this is an area of marriage where you can love your husbands and you can give to them and they can receive only from you something that they shouldn't and not get from anywhere else. That's how unique this is, isn't it? This good and precious godly gift of intimacy is totally unique and totally exclusive between husbands and wives. The Garden of Eden and the imagery in the Song of Solomon, there's a walled garden. There's a reason for that. It's a private setting. At the same time, Dave Harvey, who wrote this one, When Sinners Say I Do, he says, marriages which are sexually satisfying in private do carry into the public sphere a certain sparkle, an open demonstration of joy and unity that helps people point to the creator of marriage. But in the private confines of those walls, you are his and he is yours. Quoting the father of the prodigal son story, everything I have is yours. Naked and unashamed, here at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. And together you can say to one another, as husband and wife, I'm all yours. We've just had a look at what Peter says to the husbands. He only writes one verse for the husbands. He writes about six to the wives. I think that's because guys need it really straightforward and simple. We're not very complex creatures. Ladies, you probably know that most guys, they're not too bothered about time and place and everything else. They're quite keen most of the time. But at the same time, we do love it when we see you and put the energy and effort into life and relationship together that you might put into other aspects of life. That's a real joy and a gift that you can give to husbands. But from Peter, he has a word to wives as well. I'm not going to go through the whole passage here at the beginning of 1 Peter 3. But at the bottom of that, talking about honouring and living with your wives, and to the guys he says, honour and understand your wives. But he instructs the ladies, don't fear anything that is frightening. John's already looked at the things of headship and submission. We don't need to go there. But I actually think Peter is being really gracious here. He acknowledges that there are things that are fearful in life. He doesn't say there's nothing to be afraid of. But he does say you don't have to fear the things that are frightening. And he's speaking in the context of marriage. Husbands and wives relating together. But he notes these holy women of old are those who hoped in God. They didn't wait and hope that their husbands would one day change and become just the image of perfection that they want them to be, and they'd pick up their socks and make sure their shirts are in the right way before they put them in the wash, and then they'll love them. No, they had their hope in God, and they loved their husbands and showed that love in the way that they did. But at the end, Peter says to them, do not fear anything that is frightening. Some things frighten you. Some things concern you. Give them to God. Cast all your anxieties upon him, for he cares for you. Husbands, honour your wives and understand that there are things that frighten them. Think back to the woman in the Song of Songs. She had concerns that her husband didn't even dream of about their wedding night. In the area of intimacy. It's not just that one woman, is it? Understand that there are things that are frightening. Don't just say, don't worry, it's all okay, let me get rid of the nail. Understand. Listen. Love is patient and kind. Love doesn't just think what we see, it actually considers the other person, doesn't it? It doesn't ensure that we get our own rights or pleasure, whatever we think that might entail. Wives, you might be worried about certain things, fearful, you might feel vulnerable. But again, love believes all things. Love hopes all things. Put your hope in God and don't fear the things that are frightening. And you too can learn to understand your husband's and his different way of going about things and his pace and sense of time and place. Together, this is an area where mutually husbands and wives can give themselves to each other fully, freely, naked and unashamed, both literally and metaphorically in every way, with your bodies but also with your whole heart and soul. Two creatures made by God for each other, who he has made one flesh. It is an area of life where I think we need to take seriously. We need to take very tenderly, but we also need to enjoy and have a bit of laughter together. Even in the failures, no couple gets it right every time. It's okay to laugh a little bit. It's also an area, dare I say, where we can actually be a little bit competitive. I'm a competitive person by trait. There's one verse I've found in the Bible that actually lets me be competitive. One verse. And it's this. Romans 12, verse 10. Love one another and outdo one another in showing honour. Outserve one another as husbands and wives. Do more for her than she does for you. In every area of life. And then you've got to try to do more for him. And can you see how great that would just be? If rather than trying to get things for our own pleasure, our own satisfaction and gratification, our greatest joy is when they get the most pleasure and satisfaction and gratification. And actually that's our joy. And it's mutual. One Scottish pastor once said, the slowest thing in the world is two Christians walking through a door. After you. No. After you. No. After you. After. Might never get to bed together, but you know what I mean. Outserve one another. And that brings us to our last passage tonight. Most of us know something of the sexual revolution that took place in the 60s and the 70s. Some of us, not me, some of us here were around, might have experienced it. Well, actually, the sexual revolution started far earlier than the 60s and the 70s. In fact, Paul the Apostle was one of the instigators. At least the one sexual revolution back in Corinth. His letter to the Corinthians was written to a church in the middle of quite a sexual revolution as far as culture in Corinth went. On one hand, there was sex everywhere. There was temple prostitution, immorality in any and every degree. Just around every street corner, there was fornication. So much so that the city name was turned into a verb. You know how we've turned Google into a verb rather than a noun? Well, to Corinthian eyes, was to be engrossed in amazing sexual immorality and drunken debauchery. Just over the name of the city. Even the church there was scandalised with perversion, to the point that, at least in one instance, it said that what was going on was worse than what the pagans would put up with. On the other hand, sex may have been taking place anywhere and everywhere, except perhaps where it should have been, in marriage. There was some teaching going on that said, husbands and wives, if you are Christians now, things of the body, things of the flesh and the natural world, that's evil. It's the spiritual realm that really matters and it's really holy. So try to separate yourself from anything carnal and don't have sex. Paul had to address those situations, and he did. Corinth was very much like what today's world is, with all the magazines, all the internet, all the world and the devil throwing things at us, tantalising and tempting. It was all there. We sometimes think we've come to a point today where it's worse than it ever was. The pendulum's been swinging generation after generation, one side to the other. Different views on what relationships and sexuality should be like. From the Victorian era, where it was all meant to be kept pristine and pure, and we only did that because we had to have kids to keep the population going, to sexual revolution of the 60s, 70s, and perhaps today, where it's just what we call sexual realism. It's just an expression of our natural appetites. Make sure you do it safely and all is well. Express yourself however you like. Tim Keller, in his book, actually goes through a number of sexual ethics or historical views regarding these things. It's quite helpful. And then he says, which I hope is what we've actually received tonight, he gives a biblical ethic for sex. And that's what Paul brings in 1 Corinthians 7. Concerning the matters about which you wrote. This is what they wrote. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. This is how he responds. Verse 2. Because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement, for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Paul was a revolutionary in his day writing that. Why? Because men were told, guys, your body is not just your own. Your wife actually owns it. In a day when women had little, if any, rights, Paul's actually putting you on the same level as your husband's. And says, every right that he has to you, you have to him. And that was revolutionary in the day. He starts by correcting that misnomer, the false teaching that sex, even in the confines, or especially in the confines of marriage, was wrong. Paul says, no way, there's nothing wrong with sex inside marriage. Not within the covenant bonds of what marriage is. It's not dirty, it's not impure, it's not ungodly. In fact, he says it's necessary and it's good. Why? Because of temptation to sexual immorality, verse 2. As we said earlier, God always provides a way of escape. If you've got a computer, you're foolish not to put virus protection on, aren't you? Some sort of protection to keep it, antivirus software, keep it updated. Our marriages, our relationships, our union needs protection too. And as we said earlier, one of the ways, in fact the primary protection against sexual immorality in your marriage for married people is lying beside you each and every night. If ever the old saying, sometimes offense is the best form of defense, was true, then this is it. Your spouse is your first line of defense against sexual temptation and immorality. Now that doesn't mean it's your fault if they fall into temptation. Don't ever put that on your spouse. We've got to be responsible ourselves. But we also need to hear what Paul is saying here. Wives, the world, particularly to fellas, is full of imagery and full of stuff that we don't need to see, but it's pretty hard to avoid. There's a lot of stuff that you can avoid, but there's a lot of stuff you can't. Pray that your husbands won't fall into sexual temptation. In a world that's full of windows, like David's, as he looked down to Bathsheba. But as you pray, realise that you are part of the answer to that prayer. It's good for man not to be alone, in more ways than one. Fellas, that doesn't mean we don't have to exercise self-control. But it does mean, once again, that we're to understand one another, husband and wife together, and how our bodies work, and how the evil one works, lurking, waiting, crouching, ready to seize the opportunity to drive a wedge between us. Don't let him. Stay close together, that close together, often and regularly, Paul says. Don't withhold yourself from your spouse, not for any great length of time. And if you do, for prayer. Now, as we said earlier, there are going to be times in life where that time needs to be greater than others. Talk it through. Work things out together. Don't be afraid. Try to understand one another. And in your prayers, make sure you're praying for one another. Not just because he or she is weak and has no self-control, although Paul acknowledges that. He doesn't condemn it. He acknowledges it there. But pray for one another because Satan is ready and raring to tempt. Both of you. For one, it might be the bikini-clad girls on the beach, or the magazines in the waiting room, or the pictures on the internet. For another, it might be romance novels, or just the temptation to barter your way through life and manipulating your husband with the most powerful bargaining tool you've got, yourself. Don't do it. Don't use sex as a weapon. Don't give the evil one inch to drive a wedge between you. There's enough of a battle going on for husbands and wives. We don't need to add to the war in our own homes. Don't add fuel to the fire. As we said earlier, outdo one another in giving honour and outserving each other. Take that servant heart and that servant attitude to bed with you. One of the things Paul's saying here, I can't remember if it's John Piper or Tim Keller, but he's saying that our joy and pleasure should be at its peak. Not when you are gratified, but when your spouse is. In fact, in the mystery of the one flesh union of marriage, one partner's joy and pleasure should be indistinguishable from the other's. And that doesn't mean in perfectly timed, synchronized climax either. It simply means in receiving the joy of giving pleasure to your spouse. The greatest joy, Dave Harvey says, and what Paul is saying here is not in your own gratification, but in your generosity towards your spouse. There's so much more we could speak of. one of the greatest troubles, I think, that arrives, if it hasn't already, in marriage, is when we look outside of God's good gift of marriage and bring things in. And as we've said, the voice of the world and the devil are screaming at us loud and clear, trying to throw things in between us, even the right shoes, let alone everything else that those magazines talk of. When we put any of that external expectation or experience, whatever, and try to cram that into our own intimacy and union, things begin to break down rather than build up. And they become bitter rather than sweet. Because someone outside of that mystery and outside of that one flesh union has broken in. And it can only be the thin end of the wedge, but it can be so painful. What should have brought ecstasy and fulfillment ends up bringing pain and just lots of fear. Tim Keller writes of the many covenant renewal and remembrance feasts and festivals in Scripture, from rainbows to the feast throughout the year to remember God's covenant. And he actually says that sexual intimacy between a husband and wife serves as a covenant reminder and a covenant renewal, not just of your vows together, but of what God has brought together to become one flesh. A time when we can remember and renew love towards each other, remembering the grace in which we stand in together. I can remember for our marriage prep, Martin Bleeby, some of you know Martin, for a group of us, he said, whenever you're in an argument together, well, stand in your bedroom together, naked. Your argument will soon be over. Don't know if we've taken that up too many times, but we're thinking about that whole image of naked and unashamed. What it brings me back to is where we started, is the fact that I can know I am fully justified, forgiven, guilt-free, sin-free under Christ and in Christ. And my wife can too. And that's how I see her. And therefore there is nothing between us, is there? As we started this series, I shared something of the story of Hosea, where we see that really that no marriage is beyond redemption. Read the first few chapters of Hosea and you'll see what's happening there. But that also tells us there's no marriage bed that's beyond redemption either. The wonderful thing is, and I've encouraged our Wednesday night Bible study group to memorise this verse, not because of intimacy things, but just because it's a wonderful verse to remember, that in all things God is able to make all grace abound to you, so that having all sufficiency at all times in all things, we might abound in every good work. Grace-filled marriage, grace-filled intimacy, it's in grace we stand. Remember that, naked and unashamed together. Let me pray.